Well, welcome. Well, I'm welcoming myself, I guess, because you're already here. Welcome to me. Actually, I decided when you asked me to speak, I thought, well, okay, because it's about giving, because I really don't want to talk about my son anymore. And not that I don't want to talk about him. I don't want to talk about the loss, because it's painful, and I don't want to really go there. It's not that I don't go there. I mean, he's with me all the time, and the loss is always there. So this isn't going to be, you know, I hope, a sad speech. What I want to tell you about is what happened to me in terms of giving, because, and my husband, because I think that giving really saved us. And I just want to say that I'm not really a giving person, as Arlene is my friend, right? She can attest to that, because she knew me when. It's not like I was like always saying, like, oh, what chesed can we do? No, not at all. No, uh-uh. In fact, my parents weren't like that either. I come from a family, like, nobody really did anything. We just sort of hung out and... You know, we were Jewish, but we weren't really connected to the Jewish community. And so this is all like a shock, really, a surprise, a huge shock. That the way, really, that we were able to, I don't even want to use the word turn around, because it never turns around. It's always there, the loss. But the way we were able to, even the word cope, like there's the words just, they're not strong enough. The way we found to live with it, really, was to turn it into giving. And I feel like sort of Hashem helped us with that. So I'll give you an example. Kobe was killed when he was 13. He was with his friend Yosef Ishran. And he was killed on May 8th. So June 14th, was his birthday. It would have been his 14th birthday. And in Tekoa, where I live, I have a very good friend. Her name is Shira. And in Tekoa, she worked as an English teacher. But in America, she had trained as a pastoral counselor. And she had even studied with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. How many of you have heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross? Because, yeah, a lot of people, now the people who are just coming out of college, they don't hear about her so much. But when we were in college, when we were in college, she was a big name because she dealt with death, actually, and facing death. So Shira had trained with her, and Shira came to me every day after Kobe was killed. And really, I don't think I can ever describe how bad the pain is, because the pain, Kobe was only 13, he was my oldest, we were really close. Every day, like even that day, I was on my way home. I wanted to tell him something very funny that had happened that day, because he loved to laugh. And so when he was gone, it was like that pain every day, because I kept looking for him. And how could it be that he wasn't with us? And so she would come to me every day, and I felt like she gave me a place, just that I knew that I wouldn't die. I really felt like I would die from the pain, and I wanted to, but not really, because, you know, I had a family. So she came every day, and she said, it was Kobe's birthday coming up, and she said, you have to do something to mark his birthday. And it was just 5 weeks after he was killed, and I had no idea what to do. And we went downtown in Jerusalem, and we were going to go to Burger King, because we had come from Silver Spring, and, you know, you couldn't get kosher Burger King there. And Kobe, he loved hamburgers, and he was such a carnivore. So for him to be able to get kosher Burger King, that was, like, the most fun. So we thought we'd celebrate by going to Burger King, but we just walked by there. And we ended up going to a vegetarian place, which he would have hated. He would not have wanted to go there. So... And I was crying, and the kids went. It was the Village Green, and they went up and they ordered. And I put my head, they were little. They were 12 and 10 and 6. And I put my head down on the table, and I was crying. And I thought, what am I going to do for Kobe's birthday? And I was crying, and then this, I can't remember exactly now how it happened, but anyway, the kids, oh yeah, I was crying, and then the kids came back to the table, and I said, oh yeah, these words fell into my head, 14 beggars. And I said to them when they came back to the table, I said, I know what we're going to do for Kobe's birthday. We're going to give money to 14 beggars. And I gave them money, and I gave them a lot of money. And they were really excited with all the money. And the minute after I gave them the money, a man came to our table, and he had one of those cards that said that he was deaf and mute. And I was like, we were so happy to see him. And we gave him all our money. No, well, not all, because we had to get another 13. But it was like, usually in my former life, which was before that, I would have been annoyed by this beggar. Like, you know what? I'm eating. Could you please not? Don't. Just leave me alone. I want to eat nicely. And here it was like, oh, my God, we needed this beggar. We needed him. And then I said to the kids, we have to go get another 13. And we went out on Ben Yehuda. And we saw a beggar. It was actually on Yafa then. And he was like two blocks away. And he was walking away the other direction. We went chasing him. And we found him. We gave him the money. And then we went up Ben Yehuda. And there were people there. But like one guy, he had his foot up on a bench. His leg up on a bench, and we thought like maybe he was a beggar, and but he wasn't. He wasn't. And you can't ask somebody, are you a beggar? You can't. So we couldn't find beggars. We found like four or five, and then I went home and I told my husband what we had done. And he said that he would go to the hotel the next day to give out the rest of the money. And after that, I read a story by Shlomo Carlbach, and it was called The Holy Beggar. And he said a holy beggar was somebody who was begging to create love. And I knew that that was Kobe's birthday present to us, that he had turned us into holy beggars, because that was the only thing we could do. It was like, what were we going to do to celebrate his birthday? And that story, that paradigm kind of turned things around a little bit. Because we saw that we needed to give in order to feel whole or to find any kind of hope in the world. And actually, after that, for Kobe's birthday, for a lot of years, we went looking for beggars. And with the kids, and every year we added a beggar, until one of my sons said to me, you know, what's going to happen after you guys die? Kobe's going to be like 80, and we're going to have to give like $8,000 in one shot. Like we're not going to do this. So we kind of, but thank God life now has gotten in the way, and every year we think, should we go? And then for some reason we can't do it. So anyway, I have to thank my husband, who's not here, who should be speaking as well, because he really was the energy behind the foundation, because he was a Hillel director, so in America, and he knew how to put together an organization and how to put together programs. And we wanted to do something for Kobe and Yosef, and we wanted to do something they would like and something they would think was fun. And this also sounds crazy, but after Kobe was killed, well, when I think about all these things, it just doesn't seem possible. A week later, it was about 10 days later, the chief rabbi came to Tekoa, and he was going to bless us. And Rina, Yosef's mother, was at the shul, and they came and got me. And the rabbi gave us a blessing, and it was the Sephardi rabbi. And I remember he was dressed in like a really ornate robe and outfit and costume, and I could hear Kobe in my head saying, what kind of dress is this? What's he wearing? And then I came out, and all of a sudden I see, we lived like a minute from the shul, all these people coming out of my house. And there was, Gavi, my six-year-old, came out, and he says, Hayakadur, Hayakadur, there was a bullet. And it turned out that the Palestinians had fired, I can only use this word here, a Hail Mary pass. Israel, I guess you know what that is. A Hail Mary pass, I mean, meaning that they just fired it and it went through our house. So we had to leave our house. And where was I going with this? I have no idea. Why was I talking about that? It'll come back to me. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it'll come back. You know what? I really can't remember. Because I really didn't want to give this speech. I had another speech. What was it? All right, it'll come back. Anyway, I'm going to go to the Sheva because this is important. This is another important part of the speech, and hopefully I'll be able to remember why I'm saying it. during the Sheva, my husband reminded me this morning that all of Kobe's class came to the Sheva, and it was awful. Whenever I looked at them, I just felt like I just didn't want to see them because it was too painful. And they were in pain, I was in pain, we were in pain, and nobody knew what to say. Anyway, they kicked. Seth said, can you tell stories about Kobe? And so the boys, they kicked one of the boys up to the front. They said, tell them. And he didn't want to talk. He was a really little kid. And he had glasses. And he didn't want to talk. And finally, the big boys were like pushing him and kicking him. And so he said, you know, this last week we had sport in class. And I'm the worst athlete. And Kobe was the best athlete in the class, because Kobe was a really good athlete. And he said, and they made Kobe the captain of the team and another boy. So Kobe got the first pick, and Kobe picked me. And my daughter, she looked at me, and she's like, Kobe picked him? Like, how can that be? Because Kobe was really competitive. And like, when he rooted for the Dallas Cowboys, and then once they started losing, he just went to another team. I mean, he didn't. But we realized because we had come from Silver Spring when he was in fourth grade. He was killed when he was in eighth grade, so he'd only been in Israel like 5 years. Doesn't seem possible. And he knew when we moved, he didn't speak Hebrew. And if you've ever been in a class of Israeli kids, there were 40 boys in his class in fourth grade. And even though some were English speakers, they don't speak English in class where he was. They only spoke Hebrew, and he had no idea what was going on. And the only thing that saved him was sports. In fact, I found out later he didn't speak for 2 years in class, even though he was very smart. And we didn't help because we would get his report cards and it would be like a 10, and I didn't know if that was good or bad. For a long time, and the 10 at that point wasn't good. So like we were no help to him. But he understood, no, a lot of Olim parents were, you know, we don't know what's going on here. we really don't. Unless you're married to an Israeli, maybe that would help. So he wasn't the kind of kid who would have picked the last kid to play with. But he had developed that empathy because he had come in as the boy that, like, nobody knew and nobody really wanted to be friends with. So he had learned this kindness. And in our family, we didn't know he was like that. Because at home, it's not like he was so nice to us. I mean, he was a regular kid. He really was. So we got the idea to do a camp because we wanted to do something that he would like. And that first year we did the camp, we had like 100 kids. That was in 2002. He was murdered in 2001. So already we had 100 kids at the camp. We let them bring their friends because it was during the Intifada and nobody knew us. And these were parents who had lost their loved ones, you know, to terror. And here we were taking them away to a 10-day sleepaway camp, which also Israelis don't really know about. So that first year we had 100 kids, and then the following year we had 500 kids in the camp. And everybody had lost a mother or a father or a sister or a brother to terror. One day one of the girls got off the bus. This was a few years later, and her counselor looked at her, and her counselor saw that she had like a scar on her wrist. And she looked at her, and she told the girl, let's call her Tamar, the camper, told the counselor that she had been cutting herself. And so the counselor told the head counselor, and we have a psychologist, and we all decided, we didn't know if this girl should stay, and we called the mother, and the mother said, no, please let her stay. And the girl wanted to stay. And at the end of camp, as they were getting up on the bus, the counselor told us this story. She looked at Tamar's hand, and the scar had healed. And Tamar said to her, you know, time doesn't heal loss, but love does. Because she'd gotten so much love for her from her counselors. And that's really the theme, that it's really love that heals. And it sounds cliche, but what is chesed? It's really love. It's really finding that love and finding that love within yourself to give to other people. Now, the interesting thing about chesed is that it can also mean its opposite, what's called a contronym. It can also mean disgrace, chesed. So a lot of people, I think one thing that saved me is that I could receive. I got a lot of help from people, and my family got a lot of help from people. I had friends from Efrat, well, actually, people that I didn't know. They made us meals, Shabbos meals, for months, till the point where they weren't doing such a good job. And and my husband probably finally said, you know what, I think you can cook better than this. But it took a really long time, and I didn't even know who they were. And every Shabbos, these meals appeared. And it was the food, because I didn't want to, Shabbos is also like something you have to have koach, you have to have energy to do. But it was also that they cared. And that's part of coping with loss, is that if you feel alone in it and the isolation, that will destroy you. So that's why when we bring the kids at home, they don't talk about loss. They protect their families, they protect their parents. And also with the kids we serve, you would never know that they had problems, our kids, because the kids at Camp Kobe, because they look like regular kids, and they're not going to open up to you until they feel safe, and they won't open up at school. One time I gave a speech in an Israeli high school. Actually, I had to speak in Hebrew in an Israeli high school. It was like really embarrassing. And afterwards, one of the kids came up to me, and she said, this was in Ashkelon, she said, you know, I go to the camp. Like, we've been doing the camp now for 14 years, and every year there's about 400 or 500 kids, so I don't remember all the kids. And she said, she was one of the kids at Camp Kobe, but she said, don't tell anybody. Nobody here knows. Because they don't know how to talk about it, and it's a very, very hard thing to handle. So I had friends who, actually, she wasn't a friend then. She was just somebody I knew. I live in Tekoa on a yishuv, a settlement. And one woman came. I remember I saw her at like 11 o'clock at night during the Shiva cleaning my bathroom. She's a Radcliffe graduate, this woman. And everybody came and helped me. And I realized that there were some people who could not talk. Really, they couldn't talk. They would just say, I can't. Like, this one woman, but she would come, and I'm telling you, she would do our laundry. Like, I feel like everybody has something to give, and some people did help me. Some people came and told me things that really, really helped me. so I think that's the story of giving, that we all have something particular that we can give. What happened was I was given so much that I felt like I had to sort of pass on the giving. And one day, Rina Ishran, she's Yosef's mother, I saw her, and she said she was doing terrible. She had no time for herself, and she had gone right back to work. In fact, while during the Shiva, she was studying to be a nurse, and she was studying for the finals during the Shiva. Like, she never took the time to heal. And she said she just needed some time to herself. And so I got the idea to do retreats for bereaved mothers. And somehow, like that week, there was a group from America that we met with, and they gave us funding, and we did the first retreat. And after that, we did like 30 retreats. But in the beginning, I just brought my friends, because one of my friends was a massage therapist, one was a grief counselor, and one did EMDR, which is a trauma technique. So they became the staff. One thing about doing chesed or doing kindness or doing projects is that in a way you have to be willing to fail, because you're going to make mistakes and not everything is going to turn out right. Like once somebody gave me money for to do something in our yeshiva for Kobe's yahrzeit, for the memorial. And I got a picnic, not a, a ping pong table, like a stone ping pong table for people to use. And hardly anybody ever uses it. And you know what I mean? It's like, I thought about it differently. I thought, okay, now it's just called the ping pong memorial. I had to make that switch. And then once I made this switch, it's so weird. Last Shabbos I was walking by, or two Shabboses ago, and I saw a father and his son on Shabbos going there to play ping pong. And he looked at me, he said, this is the greatest thing, this ping pong table. So I feel like it wasn't, but you know, you have to be sort of smart about it, but you also have to be willing to like make mistakes and not know what you're doing. And I have to say, sometimes, like we started the camp and all these retreats, we do a lot of healing groups. And when we started, we had like no, I don't want to use the word expertise, because we did, because we were the clients really. But we had no degrees in this kind of thing. And now when we meet with psychologists or experts, they always tell us, you did the exact right thing. And it's because we knew from inside. So it's always good, like probably some of you are going to train to be professionals. It's always good to ask the people that you're actually working with what they need. And I find that that's very rarely done, very rarely. In fact, when they have conferences on terror, they don't invite terror victims. They invite the professionals. I mean, I became a professional. I was trained as a pastoral counselor because I felt like I needed to know more about it. But I actually knew a lot. What else do I want to say? Well, in the Torah, we learn about this chesed from, first of all, Hashem, who created the world. And really, it was an act of chesed. And when we do chesed, it's like we're imitating God in a way. And God also had to constrict himself in order to create the world. And when we do chesed, real chesed, that's what I learned in my pastoral counseling class, was really how to be able to constrict myself. Because when you're talking, let's say, to a bereaved person or somebody, I worked in the hospital, you don't want to just be bringing your own stuff along and talking about what happened to you and what you think about things. You have to learn to constrict yourself, but not in a place of, like narrowness, in a place of really expansion, that you don't need to discuss your own needs. So I think like when you're able to really give, you are really imitating God in a way. And that the whole universe God created with this idea of giving. Oh, you're back there. Hi. I mean, all of you. I can see you. Okay. This giving and receiving, that the whole world is about giving and receiving, chesed and gevurah. So it's not only to be able to give, it's to be able to receive. You have to be able to receive. And I think that's what I was going to talk about when that rabbi came and blessed me. And I forgot the story. Yeah, that's what I was going to discuss. It's about receiving. You have to be able to receive. If you can't receive, you're not going to be able to give. And we saw that with a lot of mothers that and families, because they don't want help, they don't want to talk, they want to go right back to life. And if they don't go through the process, if you are in a trauma and you don't go through a process, you're never going to come out of it. You're never going to heal. And even when I was working in the hospital, I saw amazing people who were dying and could still give. Like, there's always something to give. There, I worked with a man, he couldn't eat anymore, and he was dying. But for some reason, we started talking about food, and he gave me this recipe for lamb stew. And he told me, first you put eggplant. I'll never forget this. You put eggplant in the stew, and you put it in tomato sauce. You let the eggplant cook until it dissolves. Have any of you ever made a recipe like this, where the eggplant totally dissolves? And then you put the meat, and he told me where to get the meat, and he told me where to get the spices. And as he was going into this elaborate recipe, then he told me what to do afterwards the next day. After it's, you just have the sauce, then you take bread, and you just dunk the bread. And it was like we were sharing a meal in the world to come. And I felt like this man, even though he knew he was dying, he was still able to give. So, where else? Okay, I want to just end with this story. I guess I want to see if there's something else. Oh, I have two more stories. Wait, do I have time for two more? Okay, once you give to somebody, first of all, they'll never forget you. Usually if it's a good gift, you know. They'll also remember you if it's a bad gift, right? But if it's the right gift. So I also got involved during the prisoner exchange, when they were after Gilad Shalit, the next prisoner exchange, when they were going to let out about like hundreds of Palestinian prisoners for as a goodwill gesture. I got involved with that with the other mothers because I work with bereaved mothers, and we made an organization called Forever Mothers. We're all bereaved mothers to fight against the prison exchange. And we went to the Knesset, and one day I made my own demonstration. Now, I want to say I'm not really a political person, but this just got me so upset that Kobe's killers haven't been found. But that they could be found and then released from jail was too much for me to bear. And also some of the women we work with, their children, like one woman, Shira, her baby, a one-year-old, was killed in her house, in her caravan, by a prisoner who had been released in a previous exchange. So we went. I made this demonstration overnight on Facebook, and I had like 50 people in front of the Prime Minister's office. And we made. I got somebody. I didn't know what I was doing really, and like I went to the Makolet right before the demonstration. I thought, oh my God, I need signs. And thank God there. I'm terrible in art. Thank God there were these, like B'nai Akiva, Madrichim in front of the Makolet. So I got that. They made me signs. Great signs. And then we went, and I gave them out at the demonstration. And we had a great time at the demonstration. And then, you know, we were cheering. My sister made up a cheer in America for us. And we cheered in English. We cheered in Hebrew. We really had a great time because we wanted to do something. Everybody felt so powerless. And then all of a sudden, the police came. And they looked at us, and then they said, you know, who's in charge here? And I'm like, I looked around, I'm like, I am. And I'm like, okay, I'll go to jail. That's what I thought to myself. You know what? I will go to jail. I am ready to go to jail for this. And they're like, do you have a permit? And I said, no, I don't have a permit, but I heard you don't need a permit if it's under 50 people. They're like, no, that's not true, you know, in Hebrew. And then we started talking. It's two young women, police women. And they look at me, and she looks at me, and she's like, Atme Karen Kobe Mendel? you know, are you from Karen Kobe Mandel from Machane? I'm like, yeah. And she's like, oh, you're Sherry. She's like, I went to Camp Kobe. I went to Camp Kobe. And then the other one was like, the other policeman was like, come on, yell it, but you have to do something. And she said, no, it's okay. It's okay. So it's because we made this camp that I didn't get arrested. So, you know, I mean, I had no idea. I had no idea that it would lead to that. But I really feel like Hashem, once you turn into a giver, once you see your place in this world as a giver, then Hashem helps you. He helps you give. And he, not that he rewards you, but he just makes it that you can keep giving, I think. And so I just want to close with this story because Seth, one year he was in Toronto, and it was Yom HaZikaron, he was speaking, and he told the story about Kobe and the boy who wasn't good in sport, in volleyball. And he told how Kobe had helped that boy. And so there was, then he came back to Israel, and he got, oh no, afterwards a boy came up to him, a 16-year-old boy who was in the audience, and said, you know, I didn't mean to come to your speech. I was on the, to JCC, I was on the way to play basketball. But I came in, and I heard that speech you made about Kobe, and about the way Kobe helped the volleyball boy. And he said, and that really made an impression on me, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to choose the worst boy. He said, I'm a very good athlete, and I'm the head of the basketball team, and I'm going to choose the worst boy. So that's what he said. Seth went back, came home, and then like a few days later, he got an email from this kid. And the kid said, Dear Rabbi Mandel, I did what I said I was going to do. We had a basketball tournament. I picked for my, they made me captain. For my first choice, I picked the worst kid in the class. And he said, I saw how happy he was. I saw this, what he looked like. He was so relieved. Then I picked the second worst kid. And then I picked the third worst kid. And the whole team was the worst kids. And you're not going to believe it. You're not going to believe it. We played. We won our first game. It was a round robin tournament. And we went on to win the whole tournament. So Seth wrote back, you know, he said, I don't know where in the Torah it says that a dead person can come back to help a sports team. But if Kobe could have, I'm sure he was with you. And the kid said, and I felt him. Helped him with us. So there is something about this giving that really can work miracles. And actually, when you think about it, it's after Abraham gives to the angels when they come and they don't even need to eat. And there he makes his wife cook, which I don't think is very nice. Maybe I think he cooks too, or the servants cook. But it's after he serves them that meal that Hashem says, that, or the angels tell him that they're going to make a miracle, that Sarah's going to give birth. So there is something in this giving that can lead to miracles. So I bless you that when you're doing these projects, that you can think of it not just as like volunteer work or something, you know, you sort of want to do, but something that really can change people's lives, but most of all can change your lives. Okay, thank you. Okay. Oh, before I forget, we're running in the 10K. I'm running the 10K. So if you can do it, every single person in this room. It's on March 13th, and if you want to run with us, I have brochures, and it's a great experience running through the old city, and it's really fun. So if you want to join our team, you just have to raise some money, but you don't have to raise that much money, and it's just really a good time. And if you want to buy my book, it's like 60 shekels. Or if you want to make just a donation to the foundation, it's 100 shekels. Okay. You have questions? a revenge. Well, did I want them found? Do I want the killers found? Yeah, but I thought they would. I actually thought they would be, because the army promised us, and Yosef's father is an Israeli policeman. So I kind of just thought, well, if anybody can find them, he can, you know, he's a policeman. But then once the prison exchanges started, it was like, no, I don't want to go there. They really let out killers. Like, I have friends, they sat in their kids' trials. With the murderers, and then the murderers were put in jail for 2 years and released. And it's not like you can rely on justice in this country, unfortunately. Not when there's not in terms of terror. Well. In America, there was something called, it was the Colby Mandel Act. There was an act in Congress. It passed as an omnirider. They took his name off. But it was so the Department of Justice would be involved in pursuing the killers of Americans in Israel and in foreign countries. So they were involved for a while. But they also dropped the case. So, it's hard. Like, yeah, well, I would like vengeance. I mean, don't tell anybody that. But... But I know that it would put me in a very bad place, to really go to try to pursue the killers. So it's not easy. But yeah, we went the other direction. But even if you go the direction of pursuing the killers, it doesn't mean you're going to have a satisfactory conclusion here. I think it's just like when you receive a lot, then you have a lot that it sort of overflows. You need to give. It's probably like children who receive a lot from their parents. Let's say a lot of love from their parents. I would guess it works the same way. No, I probably did. I probably did receive a lot of love from my parents, and I think that's why you can go back and. I think it's just natural. It's like if chesed is like water, it's like a water fountain that just overflows. You need to take all that you've been given and use it to give. Otherwise, it just is wasted. Yeah, I didn't really need to learn to receive. I was very good at that. But I see a lot of people, they can't receive. A lot of the people we work with, they don't want to be helped. It's like they just want to stay busy. They just want to be busy, and they want to go back to their lives. And so they don't let what happened affect them. But it does affect you. It enters your body. It enters your mind. It enters your consciousness. So you have to grapple with it. And if you don't, you're not going to be able to live again. A lot of them don't. A lot of people die. They get sick, they die, they get into accidents. This kind of thing, grief, it can be passed on for generations. Like, I once spoke, and there was a second generation Holocaust, like his mother had been in the Holocaust. And he came up to me, he was crying. He said, my mother, she never healed. She used to just like get on the floor of the kitchen and like scream. And she never had any way of coping with it. And like for me, it's a tikkun for me to see you, who found a way to process it. But people die of this kind of stuff. Like we see it. It's serious. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, after a certain point, we just opened it to regular bereaved people. But so we have bereaved children from all kinds of tragedies and illness and car accidents, and yeah, and also the mothers' groups we opened up. Yeah, that's a good question. Oh, that's a good question, because you would think that that's the case, like that we're being punished. So we went to Rabbi Tversky, Rabbi Avram Tversky, and we said to him, you know, like, is this, we feel like we're being punished. And he said, like, what could you have done bad enough to cause this punishment? Like, you just couldn't have done anything bad enough. So I try not to take it there. But it is a punishment, you know, even if it's not meant as a punishment. Like, it's not, I don't know, I try not to think, oh, well, it's, you know, because I ate bacon sandwiches the first 25 years of my life. No, I don't think that's the, I know that's not the cause, but no, I think God is so big, and we know so little that, also I've had so many strange things happen that I feel like God keeps in. This sounds a little weird, in touch with me. That's my book, actually, is about that. It's called The Blessing of a Broken Heart, and it's all this contact, mostly through birds. But, yeah, I mean, there is that idea of punishment. So, I don't know. I try not to let it destroy me. Yeah, because I had this whole thing with birds the year after Kobe was killed, where somebody came to me from the Yishuv, and he said, I had a dream about Kobe, and he said, Kobe came, this was like a month after Kobe was killed, he said, Kobe came to me, he said, he's doing very well, tell my mother, my father, that I'm doing very well, and it's very interesting here. Yeah, and I knew that's Kobe's language, because he needed things to be interesting. He loved learning Gemara and stuff like that. You know, and he had a very good brain. So then I was with my friend Shulamit, and we were driving. I told her this story, and I said, I want to hear from him. And she said, well, I want a dream. She said, well, you can't, because when you're so disturbed, the neshama can't come to you. And just as she was telling me that, a bird hit the car and, like, flew away. And then all year, I had, like, encounters with birds. And finally, I dreamt that I talked to God. And I said, how can you say that you're a God of kindness? And God said, I am a God of kindness. I do the mitzvah of Shiluah Haken, of sending away the baby bird when you take, sending away the mother bird when you take the baby bird. So I went to learn about that, and that's a whole big story. But anyway, what I learned with somebody some Kabbalah, and the story was that in Gan Eden Lamala, like in the most hidden part of Gan Eden Lamala, there's a bird's nest. It's called the bird's nest. And it says that Mashiach waits in that bird's nest, and he waits to redeem the world. And he flies in and out, looking to see if the world is ready to be redeemed. And in that bird's nest, there are pictures, like photographs, pictures of the first and second temple, and then pictures of all the children who died Kiddush Hashem. So Once I learned that, I felt like there was something going on, because I had a lot more stuff with birds, too. Like, I was walking in Florida, in Boca, where my mother was living, and I thought, would Kobe's soul come to Boca? You know? And then also, I sat down and took out a sandwich, and a bird hit me in the head. Literally, I have had birds. Once a bird woke me up in my room by bouncing on my stomach. It sounds like I'm making this up all the time, all the time. Last week I went into my laundry room, there was a dead bird. Like everywhere I go, I'm surrounded by birds. So what does that have to do with God? I don't know. You have to know, I do. You have to read the book. You have to read the book. Okay. Do I like birds? No. No.